It's a pleasure to be back in Minnesota and back at an AA function with you all, and I want to congratulate you on your 29th intergroup anniversary. I enjoy so much being around AA. No matter where we travel, it's the same. You come into a location you haven't been to or before or for a long time, and you land on the ground, you feel like a stranger, you're just arriving, and then as soon as the AA crowd arrives, you're home. And you just have that feeling, you know, you're just accepted right in, and we feel like we're part of this crowd, and it's a nice feeling. Whenever I give a talk, I always like to, this is how I make myself comfortable, I talk to somebody who's in their first month, and I know that I know more than that person. You know what I mean? And so I just go, if there is anybody new out here tonight, why, I just want to tell you a few things about myself and about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to try and convince you to hang around here. I want to try and convince you that you have stumbled across the greatest event that will ever occur in your life. I really believe that from the bottom of my heart. However you got here, if you're like most of us, you did not get here by sitting around your home one night and it occurred to you that somewhere down the line you might have a problem with drinking. And so you picked up the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous and said, gee, I'd like to come over and join your program so that I don't get in trouble from my drinking. I mean, if I meet someone who joins under those conditions, I'm going to wonder if they have another problem of some sort. If you're a typical alcoholic, you probably got here against your will. This happens to alcoholics all the time. We go to jail, we get fired. Things are always happening against our will. And getting into AA seems to happen that way. Perhaps it was your boss called you in and said, have you got a moment? I'd like you to meet your replacement. Or maybe your family called you in and announced that we're all going on vacation without you. Or maybe your doctor called you in and said, I'd like to discuss your liver with you. If I was you, I wouldn't buy any long playing records. So we get hints in various ways from the police, the judges, all of these ways, and all of a sudden we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we go to treatment or whatever way it is, and we find ourselves at an AA meeting, and it's puzzling. I did not understand why everybody was so happy when I got to my first AA meeting. I didn't understand why people stood up and said I was arrested 12 times. And everybody howled with laughter, and then they said, then I went to a nut ward, and they're ah, ha, ha, and they're all falling down. And you sit here and you go, what is so funny about all of this stuff? And when we're new, we don't realize what's so funny. And what's funny is, it isn't going to happen anymore. That's what's funny about it. It's the wonderful relief to have gotten out of the prison of alcoholism and into the freedom that the discipline of Alcoholics Anonymous gives to us. And so, if you are new, you are in starting out on one of the greatest adventures that can happen to a human being, which is to discover the real person deep down inside of you, the one you've been afraid to look for because you knew without looking that it was horrible or that it was some uniquely different human being that set you apart from the rest of the human race. And that was why we did a lot of drinking, was to fix that sense of being different and apart from the people around us. And what's really involved is a rather strange phenomenon that comes rather difficult to alcoholics, and it involves probably one of the hardest things for us drunks to do. It involves changing your mind. Now, this may not sound like such a major event, but the alcoholics I've met, it's very close to turning the Queen Elizabeth around in the ocean. I mean, when an alcoholic changes his or her mind, they want to call a press conference. You know what I mean? And get everybody in and say, I'm about to change my position on this thing, and I want everybody to hear it because it's a monumental event that's about to take place here. I'm going to reverse my position on something. we hold on. You know, our big book talks about old ideas availed us nothing. And that's what they're talking about, is all that stuff that a friend of mine, Charlie Bruton, used to talk about. He said, it isn't so much the things that we don't know that kill us. It's knowing things for sure that just ain't so. And that's what I had. And I think all of us, especially alcoholics, when we arrive here, we know a lot of things that aren't true. And I don't know where you learned some of the stuff, but growing up, I picked up some of the most poignant insights to life off of bathroom walls. You know, you're in there and sitting there and sort of looking around, and something catches your eye and you go, I didn't know that. And since we're not into sharing, we just file it away and deal, you know what I mean? You never go out and say, you know, and we don't do that. That's not our style. We just take this information and sort of digest it and wrestle with it and put it to sleep somewhere. And we come up with a rather strange assortment of ideas as to what life is all about. And I was certainly no exception to this particular thing. I come from New England, up in the Connecticut area. Whenever I speak out in California, I always like to talk about coming from New England and pointing out, and when I speak out there, I could take great lengths to go into the detail of how both of AA's co-founders came from New England and not California. And in other words, one of the great social movements that's going on in the world didn't start in California. It's nice to find something that didn't start in California and work its way across the country from West Coast to East Coast. And I always found it ironic that the two people from Vermont would start Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that just blows my mind. You don't think of Vermont as being much of a drinking state. I mean, has anybody ever heard of a great nightclub in Vermont that everybody talks about? It seems like a rather stoical little state that sort of sits up there with a lot of snow and granite and rough sort of things. And that was the way I was brought up. I had a rather stoical approach to life, that I was taught that a real man never asks for help, stiff upper lip, you know, and just get out there and face the world and somehow deal with it with your own resources. And this was sort of the philosophy that I picked up on in the state that I grew up in. Now that I wonder about that, because now I hang around my mother and father. My mother has one of the funniest senses of humor that you can imagine. She's a very Irish woman and knows one joke after another, and I wonder where I saw all this as a little kid. And I think sometimes that maybe we saw things a little bit differently than they really were. I know that when I was brought up in the Catholic Church, I certainly saw things differently than my sister. I mean, you should hear the two of us share what we thought we heard back in those days. But my memories, clear as a bell, was at age 6, I walked in there and all the nuns gathered around and said, welcome, little boy, you're in trouble. That was, and then I heard about what life was, and it sounded like Grimmsville. You know what I mean? The odds were pretty terrible against ever making it. And so I had my early opinions about a higher power were rather negative. I saw a punishing God that sat around and was waiting for keeping score about everything I did. And it was just terrible, the problems that I was having. I remember at age 13, we had a terrible epidemic out in our neighborhood of impure thoughts. And it was just going in every house on the block. It was just awful, what was going on. And I was just sitting there going, man, this is costing a lot of years in purgatory. I mean, I could just... The cash register was spinning around. I'm going, boy, I hope I never die. And this is... I don't want to go through all that. But on the other hand, the longer I stay alive, the more it's costing me. There didn't seem to be any way to get out of this thing. Everything that seemed to be enjoyable had a downside. And I don't know. These are just the funny perspectives that we have. But I do think that, in a sense, I didn't share with anybody else. I don't remember really having close friends where we talked about anything meaningful. You know, talk about sports, or we talk about the kind of small talk. But I don't think I ever shared with anybody until I got an AA. some of my basic fears and some of my confusion about life. I was still trying to act like I knew what was going on. Now, when you think about that, that's just a typical thing that almost every teenager has to go through. You got to walk around and, you know, as a teenager, you don't know what's going on. But you got to try and act like you do, and you just, you know, and you just go, yeah, I got it all figured out, and I hadn't the foggiest idea. I had problems even when I got into the university. I went to the local university in New Haven, and people came from all over the country, very sophisticated guys, and they were all very intelligent, and I felt that feeling that happened so often. There was a tremendous difficulty in just mixing with people. In other words, it'd be a social event with 50 or 60 freshmen or sophomores standing around in a little room. It was a get acquainted session. And I'll tell you, before I started drinking, I didn't know how to handle those situations. You'd walk in and here's 49 strangers. And they all knew intuitively how to break up into little groups and introduce each other and start conversations and And I would walk in there and I'd go, where the hell am I supposed to stand? You know what I mean? I'd look around and what little group am I supposed to join? And I wouldn't have the vaguest idea, and I'd just sort of go around the edge of this crowd looking for an opening, and people would stare at you, you know, what are you doing over there? What are you, you know, and after a while it would get uncomfortable and I would leave. And that was my best shot at socializing. You know what I mean? And then I would have that feeling that things were different. And along about this time, alcohol came into my life. I was on a pledge. I think you got a million years off from purgatory if you could last till age 21 without drinking. And I was on that particular thing. But we seem to have an emergency here. And that was I couldn't get along with people. And I was balancing the two. And I decided, what the heck? And all my roommates were saying, I can't believe you're in college and you haven't had a drink yet. You got to start. This is the greatest stuff. And they started describing what whiskey would do, and that if you drink it, you're going to feel good. It goes inside of you, and it creates tremendous. I mean, you just have the most marvelous time. They were selling me on whiskey. So at the next one of these get-togethers, where I had that same feeling that I didn't belong and I didn't know how to get these conversations started, I picked up a glass of something, a mixed whiskey drink, and poured it down and waited for whatever these guys had told me was going to happen. And I remember standing there, nothing. So I got another glass. I'm willing to conduct a full experiment here. And pour down the other glass, and I'm just going, this stuff is broken. You know, I'm getting no reaction. I think it was on the third drink. And I decided that maybe I would just leave, that this was a ridiculous idea, this drinking. And I happened to glance up, and they had replaced all of the people in the room with 50 of the friendliest guys you have ever seen. Every single person in that room was looking my way and was saying, come over and join us, please. We want to meet you. And I said, hey, I'll have to spread myself kind of thin though, to get all to meet this demand for my personality. And I just went from one group to another telling hilarious jokes and going. I mean, it was just, you talk about the 14 promises of whiskey. I got the first one right off the bat. I intuitively knew how to handle situations that used to baffle me. Right out of the big book. I was given instant knowledge. I was given the power to just go out and to feel secure amongst all these people. And you know, it's funny, that first night of drinking, it didn't last very long before I was puking my guts out in the back alley. I only had about an hour of that wonderful peace of mind. But during that time, I remember suddenly feeling much closer to the church, which is the strangest feeling, you know what I mean? Because the church was always talking about brotherly love and the Christianity and the entire concept of the closeness of mankind. And I said, this is what they're talking about. I mean, this was the first time I ever experienced that. That was what that felt like. Up until then, I felt frightened by people. It was a competitive world. It was a dog-eat-dog environment, and it was who's going to win. And, you know, and I didn't see why that had anything to do with being nice to each other. So it was, I don't know, I look back, it was a typical growing up problem. All of us, as we move along growing up, got to figure these things out, except for alcoholics. We don't have to figure those out because we get a shortcut. It's called drinking. Drinking is the alternative to growing up. And that's why when we arrive in Alcoholics Anonymous at age 30, 40, 50, many of us go, I'm 18 right now. And what we mean by that is that's about how old we are emotionally, and we got a lot of catching up to do. We've got to learn how grown-ups handle problems, which means how you handle life without booze or drugs. And I thought I had come across a shortcut to all of the pain of growing up, and it was called drinking, and it was called the power of booze. And that stuff was powerful. I don't find much of a difference between vodka, which is what I ended up on. I didn't stay on whiskey that long. I soon found out that vodka does the job quickest, quietest, and cheapest. And so any smart, practical alcoholic generally ends up on a good, cheap vodka. I mean, what the hell? If you're going to just put the stuff in as a medicine, you might as well just get a generic brand, you know, and get away from all this glamour. We're not in for the glamour. We're not trying to impress anybody back in the bathroom drinking out of a briefcase, you know, so why have Haig and Haig pinch bottle back there? Who the hell's going to notice? Besides, even if they did notice, they'd go, oh, drinking Haig and Haig at 8:30 in the morning. Isn't that wonderful? So you didn't going to score too many points anyway. But the vodka, my alcoholism anyway, it reminds me so much of the spiritual program here in AA. It was a power. It was a power that I had faith in. There was a ritual associated with it. I think about bars. They remind me in some bizarre way of little spiritual groups. It's the same little crowd that's there, and we're all worshiping the same thing, and we have the commonality, and nobody wants to go home, and we want to stay there, and we have this great, and it's all phony. See, that's the difference. It's all chemical, and it feels like you have friends, and it feels like you have love, and it feels like you are close to people. And then later on that night, you're throwing up, and you know, none of that stuff is real. And then the next day, it's all gone. It's all gone. And you know, I used to watch other fathers with their children, and I was trying to behave like a father who loved his children because I didn't feel it. I didn't really feel it like I do now. And so I would go, let's see, a person who loves his children does these things. And so I would go buy presents for birthdays. I would show up at certain things, take them to games and whatever it was. But I wasn't experiencing it. I don't think a self-centered, practicing alcoholic is capable of love. And so I didn't know how to explain that. I just assumed that nobody did. I thought everybody else was a phony, the way they were talking. You know, I came in AA and go, I love you. And I'm going, puke, puke, what the hell are you talking about? I love you. You know, some guy comes over and hugs you, and you just go, what is this, a weirdo outfit? I don't, you know, I couldn't understand what was going on because I didn't have those feelings. I did not have those feelings. I had a great self-centeredness that carried me along. What I'm saying is this, I had hit a detour when I took my first drink. Up until then, I was chugging along the same road everybody else was in the process of growing up. And when I say growing up, I'm talking about becoming spiritual. That's what I mean when that's what a grown-up is to me. It is someone who has come to understand their spirituality and understands that you cannot make it through life on your own resources, and that it is not a sign of weakness to bring a higher power into your life, because that is what flows through, and that's where the love comes, and that's how the whole deal works. And that's what I kind of think of a grown-up when I use that term. And I came to this detour, and I was going along the same road the other people were, and then alcohol came along. And for me, as an alcoholic, it was a much bigger thing than it was for my roommates in college who liked to drink. For them, drinking was a way of having a little extra fun on Saturday night. It was a way of unwinding a little bit at the end of a hard day. It was not the secret to life, which it was to me. You see, alcohol held many more answers for me than it did for my non-alcoholic, although heavy drinking, roommates. For me, it was an obsession early on. And for a lot of us alcoholics, it was the answer. And it was almost like we just signed a lifetime blood pact with alcohol. And it was a single answer. No matter what the problem was, the answer was drinking. You know what I mean? I mean, somebody could come to the door and they could say, "Hey, I'm the bill collector. I need all the money. When are you going to start paying me?" And I'd go, "Let me mix a drink and get an answer for you." You know what I mean? I always drank first because I relied on alcohol to calm my fears so that I would then be able to think. I could not make decisions. I postponed decisions until I drank. And I had a great deal of faith in alcohol. I don't know about you all, but I can remember coming into AA and getting rid of all the booze. And I was going to turn my life over to this program. But I also kept a $50 bill hidden in my wallet just in case. You know what I mean? Just in case this program didn't really work. A guy has to protect his rear end, you know. You can't just go around. And so I got that, and I knew the location of the nearest package store just in case. You know what I mean? And so I had a tremendous reliance on this. I can recall being, you know, in the later stages of my alcoholism, being absolutely panic-stricken during a typical Tuesday morning. Maybe I had to go to a meeting where some senior officer was going to be present, and the mere thought of being trapped in the room for an hour with this person, they might ask a question, and I wouldn't know the answer, and I'd look bad and turn red and sweat or whatever those fears might have been. And if I could look out the window and see my car in the parking lot where a quart of vodka was in the trunk, just seeing my car parked there would calm me down. You know what I mean? In other words, the power of booze was enough so that I didn't always have to drink it to have it work. Just knowing it was there gave me enough serenity to go in and handle some of these problems. And so it was a very close personal relationship that I had with alcohol. It was my secret answer, and it was my power source. When life was too much, I would just get drinking into my system. Now, that's described my alcoholism. Now, if we're an alcoholic, we have to earn drinking money. And now we get into what some people call their careers, and I call it my hobby. You know, because I was giving about 4 hours a day to my job, and being an alcoholic was the full-time occupation. And I ended up in the Marine Corps, where I did almost all of my drinking until I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I ended up going to flight school and becoming a jet fighter pilot, and got in with a great drinking crowd, very exciting, and we went overseas and got a million great flying stories and so on down. But the bottom line was, I was an alcoholic and I had a progressive illness, and it was progressing while I was flying airplanes, the same as it's progressing when somebody's practicing law or somebody is farming a farm. It doesn't seem to matter. The illness was going along, and it was causing the same kinds of problems. And eventually, after flying for about 12 years, this illness had progressed to the point where I was consumed with fear. I mean, I just knew I was going to be found out. I was trembling. My hand shook so bad that I knew I was going to have to start drinking in the morning. I mean, I got up in the morning. I couldn't eat breakfast to try to wash down a little coffee and smoke a pack of cigarettes, you know, and that would be breakfast. and then go down and try and get out and fly a couple of flights or whatever I was doing. For a couple of years I was teaching flying, and I'd fly 4 students a day, which is enough to get a sober man sick. And I'd be in the back seat, and those guys would be in balanced flight occasionally, and the plane was skidding and zigging, and you're sitting back there going, blah, you know, just hour after hour of this stuff, and these guys trying to kill you when they're landing. And so it was just year after year of this, and the inability to share this fight with anybody. This was a very personal struggle. The progression of that illness just was taking its toll. I wasn't able to eat that much. There was all that dry heaving and sweating in the wintertime, wearing sunglasses all the time because you couldn't look anybody in the eye. Every year I became less of a person. Every year I would get promoted, I would accomplish some other accomplishment, and I would be less of a person. Because I guess I knew that all I was doing was avoiding life. I was avoiding some of the fundamental questions that keep haunting us late at night. And pretty soon there wasn't any more places to hide. You know what I mean? I just had reached sort of the end, and I was going out to get in. I was in Cherry Point, North Carolina, at the Marine Corps Air Station down there. And I was going out to fly a Crusader, an FA, a great big airplane. It's hard to fly. It's one of these things that's not an easy plane to fly. And, you know, I was having a problem finding the plane I was supposed to fly. I'm looking up and down the flight line. What number do I have? You know, and I'm asking the plane captain, and I'm getting in the thing, and they're going, "Are you all right, Captain? Are you all right?" And I'm like, yeah. But I'm, you know, I'm secretly hoping the plane won't start, because I don't want to go. I know what shape I'm in. And there was two of me. And I didn't feel that I should go up with this pilot. You know what I mean? I was making a judgment call there. And I said, why do I have to go with this guy? You know what I mean? But there was only one seat and one engine, and there you went. And I... what was happening was I was not drinking during the day. I've since joined, we got a bunch of pilots groups around, and we have a lot of fun getting together. And I've talked to a lot of other pilots, and they said, you should have been taking booze with you. And I realized I would have been a lot safer doing that than what I was doing, which was not drinking all day and going through withdrawals in airplanes. And that is dangerous. I mean, you're up there with the hand shaking and the eyes can't see, and I'm losing consciousness, and I'm getting heart palpitations, and you know, and a drink would have calmed me down. I might have flown another 6 months or so. But as it was, I eventually realized this was just getting after. I mean, it was just one close call after another. So I told a flight surgeon, and they agreed we had a desperate problem, and I was sent down to Pensacola, Florida for an evaluation by all of the senior doctors in the Navy, and they looked at me, and I had high blood pressure. My hands are shaking. I reeked of booze. But this was back in 1962, before the Navy had an alcohol program. They didn't even have the disease of alcoholism on the books. And so I had to be diagnosed other than alcoholism. And so they went through all 2 weeks of testing, and finally they left it up to the psychiatrist. And my case was written up as childhood fear of airplanes. And that was my official diagnosis. And I was sent back to the base, and they took away my flight status, which is like taking away my whole identity. I mean, you want to see a guy go through an identity crisis. You know, that was all I was. You know, I said, what are you? At least I could say, well, I'm a pilot. You know, it sounded like you were something, and now I'm nothing. So the drinking picked up, and I was waiting for my orders to find out what the Marine Corps was going to do with a drunken pilot who couldn't find his own car, and just to show that the insanity was spread around equally, I got a set of orders to become an air traffic controller. And somehow I made it through that school. which speaks well for us alcoholics. Amazing, some of the junk that we pull off. You know, I've heard all those other stories like this. We're talking now about that. I'm in my last year of drinking, and I make it through air traffic control school and go out and take over a little outfit, and we're bringing planes in bad weather when they can't see the runway on radar scopes, which is a very precision type thing. And I'm very grateful that I don't have any horror stories to tell you about crashing a plane or running two of them together or something like that. But that's what I was doing during the last year. So I got into daily drinking then. I was in charge, and I was back overseas, and I let everybody else do the real work, and I was simply trying to survive and make it one day at a time. And I got malnutrition. I lost about 50 pounds that year. Just have a lot of real bad stories, embarrassing stories of trying to make it to work, of riding a bicycle and falling off every day, and just sort of a mess, and people just sort of carried me along. I just didn't know how I was ever going to get out of that. I just thought maybe if I died some night, that would be the way out. But it was a very desperate type situation. And under those circumstances, I was sent back to Quantico, Virginia, which is how I ended up in the Washington, D.C. area, to go to a career Marine Corps school to become a general or something. I mean, it's like nobody noticed what's going on. And I got in that school and was there about 2 weeks when, during class one day, my body just stood up and had a grand mal seizure. And you know where you bite your tongue off and you're lying on the ground? You've seen... We used to have convulsions at AA meetings more often than we do now. Now, with all the treatment centers, we don't get to see that anymore. But, God, in the old days, we'd have about one every 2 months at least. And somebody would be sitting in the front row and go, and then you'd run out and get a spoon. Some of you old-timers remember this, and wrap a handkerchief around it, and two guys would get the jaw open and go in there and get that tongue out of the way and wait for the guy to come back. And the funny thing about convulsions is, the person having them doesn't experience any problem. You wake up and they go, hi. They don't even realize that they were just this close to death. And I remember that myself. I came out of that thing, hi, back into it again. But that ended me up, that got me out of class. There's no way to have even the Marine Corps in 1963 or 4 couldn't ignore this any longer. And I was bound up for the Naval Hospital in Bethesda, and put up in the tower so they could figure out what happened to this guy, whatever caused this seizure down in that school. And while I was there, about 2 days later, I went into the DTs. And that let the cat out of the bag as to what the seizure was, and we had a drunk on their hands. And I ended up in a straitjacket back in the nut ward, the mental psychiatric section of the Naval Hospital, where I was locked up for 6 months. I mean, those days, they didn't have an alcohol program, they didn't have AA, they just had nuts. And we would go to group therapy with all the other nuts. And they would have manic depressive, schizophrenics, you name it. And we'd sit around, the psychiatrist would go, well, what do you think about this problem and that problem? And I'll tell you, once in a while, they would make the drunks the center of the psychotherapy, and they would ask all these other people who were locked up in there, what do you think about these alcoholics? And I'll tell you why those people were locked up there. Because I'm going to tell you what they used to tell us, these weirdos. They used to say, you guys ought to stop drinking. Now, the next time I heard that was in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'm going, stop drinking? What the hell has that got to do with the problem? No wonder you're locked up in here. It made no sense to me. Made no sense at all. One day a corpsman came in. It seemed that Alcoholics Anonymous had wormed their way into the nut ward and had got the head psychiatrist to agree to have some AA meetings there. And a corpsman came on the ward and said, all drunks fall in. Right face, forward march, and that's how I got to my first AA meeting. In a little blue bathrobe with a Marine colonel next to me, and we sat down, and three guys from the Bethesda, Maryland area came in and shared a meeting, and I sat there and listened to this and went up afterwards to this little redheaded guy, and I said, geez, I was really impressed with what you were saying. It looks like a wonderful program. If I ever run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him around to see you. And he looked at me and he poked me in the chest a couple of times. He says, "Let me ask you a question." He said, "Which one of us is going to walk out that door and get into his car and drive home to his family like a regular person? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe on and go over in that elevator and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? Now, which one are you?" And I remember just going, "I can't believe this guy's talking this way. I just met him. I'm trying to be nice to him." And it was my first contact with AA's hard love, you know, where they just tell you the truth and come right out and look right at you and just say, "You're wrong." And it was shortly after that that I was let out on an outpatient basis and immediately started drinking, and had to come back in on the following Monday, and I knew they were going to find out, so I called AA. I was going to call AA and join AA over the weekend and then blame getting drunk on AA. You know what I mean? And go back to the nut ward, because they told me if I ever drank again, I was thrown out of the Marine Corps. And I called AA, and I did not reckon on my sponsor. And he was the guy who showed up at my house in response to the call. And I had gotten a drink to stay down between the time I made the call and him coming over. I didn't need him anymore. And I asked him if he could just leave some literature. And he said, "Get in the car." And I said, "No, I'd like to discuss." He says, "Get in the car." And I tried to argue a little bit, and it just came back to getting in the car. We're going to a meeting. For the longest time, I thought AA's first step was get in the car. You know, it was like, didn't matter what you say, get in the car. And off we went. I was not joining AA. I was trying to get rid of this guy. And I've never been able to get rid of him. And that was over 20 years ago. And I haven't had a drink since. And it just all happened. And so I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't deserve it. I didn't do anything to get it. I tried not to get it. I tried not to get Alcoholics Anonymous. I fought it like hell. And here I am today. And when I try and tell you the things that have happened, it is very difficult. But without a doubt, the most important thing that has happened is my relationship with my God. That is the bottom line, single most important thing that has happened to me in my life, was to have that perspective changed and have that power flow into my life. And if you're new, you got to think about this. This is what AA is about. It's a spiritual program. And the first step talks about being powerless over alcohol. And if you're buying that, you better watch out. Because the only answer to being powerless is to find a power. And it doesn't say that we're going to learn about alcoholism. It doesn't mean that you're going to get educated about alcoholism. You're just going to pray for a power. That's the only answer to being powerless. You cannot learn your way out of powerlessness. You have to ask your way out of it. And that's what a spiritual program is. It is simply asking for the gifts that have just been set aside for you that, due to our self-centeredness and our pride, we refuse to ask for. We just didn't want to go through the effort of making ourselves prepared to receive all of the wonderful gifts that are out there. And the 12 steps, as our 12 and 12 indicates, is AA's way of making each one of us ready to receive the gift of sobriety. And they're plain as day. They're all in all the meetings, these 12 steps, and it involves sharing and inventorying and understanding what we're really buying here and learning a day-at-a-time program and making amends and learning something about prayer and meditation and eventually having a spiritual awakening so that we recognize the personality change that is really set in us. And the program is, let me just take a few minutes to share what I think about a spiritual program, in case you're new. And I'll do it by going back to a John Lennon song, which I cut out of Time magazine when he was assassinated, because I was drinking a lot of the time during there, and I never did listen to their music nor understand, you know, really know what the words were. But this song was in Time magazine, and I looked at it and I went, "Boy, there's Alcoholics Anonymous." And his song was "Watching the Wheels Go Round." And the lines in it were, "People go by lost in confusion, and I tell them there's no problems, only solutions. And in AA, that's what we work on, is the solution. We don't sit around and screw around with problems all the time. We got 12 steps. We have the solution. And you know what happens to our alcohol problem? If you're new, you don't figure the alcohol problem out. We don't understand it. We don't get it understood so that we don't have to deal with it. What happens to our alcohol problem is it gets removed. This is for the spiritual solution. We have the worst problem in our lives simply removed from our lives. And the way it's done is we focus in on going to meetings, on helping other people, on working the 12 steps. And suddenly we notice that we forgot to think about drinking yesterday. For an alcoholic to go a whole day without thinking about drinking is a miracle. Something that we obsessed about all the time. It is something that I cannot do of my own volition. There is no way that I can use my own willpower to not think about alcohol. You ever think about that? You get up in the morning, okay, today I'm not going to think about drinking. And then 3 seconds later, here goes your brain. Budweiser. Okay, I'll start over again. I'm not going to think about drinking. And the harder you try not to think about drinking, the more you focus in on drinking. And, you know, you're just fighting it. And they go, well, you're going to have to just surrender that and work the program. And you go, well, how the hell is that going to guarantee anything? It looks like I'm not working on the problem. It says, stop with the problem, work on the solution. And this is a hard lesson for us material-oriented free enterprise society to get incorporated into our lives, that we're going to do something that's backwards to the way we run the rest of our lives, but that's exactly the way it is. And I don't know about you, but I had three great examples of this that I'll share with you before I sit down. And that is, you ever go, I don't know if the discussion meetings out here run the same as they do back in Washington, but back there, the leader of a discussion meeting reads the preamble, and then he says, before he introduces his topic or her topic, before I introduce my topic, does anybody here tonight have a problem you'd like to discuss? And then we have 5 seconds of silence because nobody ever raises their hand. And then he goes, okay, the topic tonight will be resentment. And we go around the table or the fourth step or something like that. Once in a while, somebody who's all bent out of shape will get their hand up in the air and you'll go, yes. And then the person will say, well, I'm still upset that Washington doesn't have a baseball team. So I'd like that to be the topic tonight. And then the whole meeting gets a resentment. They go, what the hell's that? That's not an AA topic, the Washington Redskins or the Washington Senators. And then we go, what did we ask the guy for, you know? So I very carefully never raise my hand at any of these meetings unless something was screwed up. And I can think back in the 20 years I've been in AA, I've probably had my hand up 3 times because I was so screwed up. And the first time was probably around 2 years of sobriety. I went to a meeting every night and got thrown out of the Marine Corps. Now, that was not fair, right? I mean, here I got sobered up and getting my act together, and they part company with me. They don't promote me and force me out, and there goes the end of my career. I thought that was not the way I thought AA should work. So I had quite a resentment about that. And I let it build up for a couple of months, and finally at a discussion meeting one night, I lost control of myself, and somebody said, anybody got a topic? And I said, I got a topic. The topic is getting thrown out of the Marine Corps. And I feel this is a terrible injustice. I got all these kids, and I got no money and a job, and I'm we can't get started again. And so they said, well, fine, let's discuss Sandy's problem. Call on the first guy, and he says, thrown out of the Marine Corps, huh? How about the Serenity Prayer? And I went, the Serenity Prayer? What the hell has that got to do with getting thrown out of the Marine Corps? I'm trying to talk about a problem here tonight. Next guy says, if I was you, I'd go out and help somebody new. Well, boy, you know, I started going, I know what the problem is. They didn't hear me. It's obvious from the feedback that I'm getting they didn't hear what I said. It probably went right over their heads. The next guy said, the prayer of St. Francis is what I would recommend in the 11th step. Lord, make me a channel. And the last guy said, you got to turn it over. And I said, but I'll tell you, that's the last time I go to that group. I'm never going back to that group again, nor am I ever going to raise my hand again. But lo and behold, about 8 years later, I was having marital problems. My whole family life was falling apart and divorced, and the kids are going and other people out of the house. And, you know, I got, I am really So I'm at a discussion meeting, and the guy says, well, anybody got a problem? And I go, yes. What about getting thrown out of your house and the kids and the blah, blah, blah. Oh, marital divorce, etc. Have you tried the serenity prayer? And the next guy says, find somebody new and work with him. And the next guy says, prayer of St. Francis. Lord, make me a channel. Works every time. Prayer of St. Francis. And the last guy says, you got to turn it over. And about 6 years later, I was in the real estate business, and the money market dried up. Couldn't get a mortgage anywhere. And I'm going bankrupt, financial creditors, and I've got a whole bunch of years of sobriety. And I don't think that's right that anybody who's been sober that long should be broke. So I had my hand up, and now I'm going to discuss money problems. So what about when you don't have any money and you know what happened? That first guy said, serenity prayer. That's what you need. Next guy said, the prayer of St. Francis. And next guy said, find a new person. Go out and try and help them. The last guy said, turn it over. So what we have here is an answer. What we have is a solution. And if we work on that and focus on that and concentrate on that and then turn back and look at the problems, I don't know where they go. I just don't know where they go. Somehow AA gives us a new pair of glasses. It gives us the ability to look back at life and see it from a whole new perspective. Just like alcohol, Alcoholics Anonymous alters my perception of reality, as Clancy I likes to say. It gives me the power to see things from a much higher level than the gutter. And when I'm up there, where you can carry me through sharing and through the power of this program, things look just great, a day at a time. In closing, let me tell you what I think about sharing, because we hear so much about it in the program. Sharing works like this. One of the person in this little quotation is you, and the other one is your sponsor, and see if you relate to this. The sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling. No, it isn't. Oh. And that's just the way it works. You just go, oh, it's not? Oh, good. And that's all it takes sometimes, is you just go, oh, and, well, I thought it was. From here, all by myself, that's what it looked like. And then they go, no, it isn't. Oh, good. And then the whole goddamn world straightens out just like that. And you can't straighten it out alone. We need each other. We have to stay together. If you stay in the middle of AA, there's no way you can slip off the edge. You stay with these people, those of you that are brand new, and you are in for a most remarkable life. And I hope I'm around to see it. Thanks a lot.